WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A suicide bomber in Jerusalem today shattered more lives and, for many, the fragile hopes for some end to the escalating violence in the Middle East. Coming up this hour, is there no other way? Could nonviolence ultimately be the only way to peace? First, a coup in Venezuela. Tensions mounted yesterday when police killed at least 10 and wounded more than 100 people as hundreds of thousands of protesters gathered outside the presidential palace. Today, President Hugo Chavez resigned from office and is under military custody. Phil Gunson reports from Caracas for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him what sparked the political upheaval in Venezuela.
Well, I suppose you could say that at root it's the presidential style of the now ex-president Hugo Chavez, an ex-military man who seemed to see politics as a constant round of confrontations rather than an exercise in building consensus. And a lot of the time, I think the problems that he built up for himself could have been avoided if he'd been concerned to engage in serious negotiation. But what sparked the denouement, this crisis, was the issue of control of the state oil company. Mr. Chavez imposed a new board, which the management of the company saw as being incompetent to run it, as lacking the experience to run it. And the refusal of the government, in particular the refusal of the president, to even contemplate negotiating over this, led to industrial action in the oil company, which sparked eventually an indefinite general strike.
Hugo Chavez resigned earlier today. What were the events that led right up to that resignation?
There was a mass demonstration yesterday in support of the oil company management. And when I say mass, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people, the biggest demonstration ever seen in Caracas. Eventually, this demonstration marched on the presidential palace, whereupon unarmed demonstrators were fired upon by snipers from rooftops, by gunmen at street level, and even by uniformed members of the presidential guard. At least a dozen people were killed. The president did everything he could to stop footage of this appearing on local television, but when senior military officers saw what was going on, they turned against him en masse, and the president lost all military support. It took him until about 4 in the morning to decide to turn himself in, but that's now the situation. He's a guest in the defense ministry, if you like.
Had the military been waiting, looking for an opportunity to turn against Hugo Chavez?
There was a lot of discontent within the military, and it's very clear now that the government's claims that the military was solidly behind what they called the revolution were completely false. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that the bulk of the military has demonstrated that it is predominantly institutional. There was no real enthusiasm for a coup in the traditional sense. But once civil society had shown that it was prepared to go all the way against this president, then military officers who were already discontented with Chavez decided to move.
Phil Gunson, beyond Hugo Chavez's aggressive or grating style, what are the fundamental tensions in Venezuelan politics and society that are being played out here?
Well, President Chavez was a man who claimed to be engaged in a revolution to improve the lot of the poor majority in Venezuela. He said that he'd come to power to get rid of corruption, to install a government in which the poor would run the show and the rich would be compelled at least to pay their way in society. Unfortunately, he didn't really deliver on any of his promises. He didn't get rid of corruption. By most measures, it got worse. He didn't deliver economic health. And despite the fact that he had enormous popular support to begin with and control of all the key institutions of society, he squandered that by his inability to build consensus, as I say.
What politics does his successor, the businessman Pedro Carmona, bring into the presidential role?
Well, Carmona is, I think, a convinced Democrat. He's a businessman. He's an economist. He's a man with a good deal of international contacts. He's noted as a moderate and a conciliator. He's, in a sense, the polar opposite of Chavez. He's a man that I think can bring people together, both within Venezuela and in terms of Venezuela's rather tattered international relations. He's still to build his government team. We don't know exactly who will be gathered around him. But I think, as I say, he's a man who can bring people in to his team and should be able to put together quite a competent team.
In Cuba today, Fidel Castro called the unseating of Chavez a counter-revolutionary plot by the subversive rich. What's been the relationship with Cuba, and what does Castro's view suggest?
Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez have had a very close relationship indeed, almost like father and son. Chavez admires Fidel Castro enormously, and that hasn't gone down very well in Venezuela. Opinion polls have consistently shown that very, very few Venezuelans are interested in turning Venezuela into a kind of Cuba. I think it's not surprising that Fidel Castro would see the events in that way, but this whole idea that there was a conspiracy by a minority of oligarchs, as Chavez was fond of calling them, is a false one. We, as I say, we had nearly 500,000 people on the street yesterday, and they certainly weren't all oligarchs.
So what do you think, Phil Gunson, this change means ultimately for the Venezuelan people and, I guess, for the oil industry?
Well, for the Venezuelan people, I think it means, for many of them, the majority, I would say, at this point, it means the end of a period of great stress, and in the sense that they're happy to get rid of President Chavez. He was irritating them profoundly. But, of course, it doesn't mean the end of the problems. This is a country which does have a serious structural economic problem, and the new government will have difficulties on that level, and also difficulties in reconstructing a political system that has reached almost the point of collapse. In terms of the oil industry, it means a return to full production, and in the longer term, I think, will probably mean a move away from the OPEC policy of restricting production to improve prices, more in the direction of an emphasis on production and market share. But I think that's something that will probably come after the transitional phase.
Phil Gunson, is the United States seen as having played any role in this change, or has this been entirely a Venezuelan affair?
Well, there's no doubt that the United States is happy to see the back of Hugo Chavez. They may, for all I know, have been moving behind the scenes in one way or another to facilitate the removal of Chavez. But I think it would be wrong to concentrate on that angle to the exclusion of what I think is by far the most important element of the current situation, which is that the people of Venezuela, in a very peaceful and democratic way, rose up against their president and were eventually compelled to remove him.
Phil Gunson reports from Caracas for the Christian Science Monitor. Six people are dead in Jerusalem and at least 60 more wounded in an attack today by a female suicide bomber at a crowded city bus stop. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict has escalated, given a terrible momentum by growing desperation on both sides. Even U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, sent to bring the two sides to some sort of talks, has postponed his meeting with Yasser Arafat. The whole situation seems as far from resolution as it has in any point over the past half century. Tonight, against all odds, we're exploring another path, nonviolence. For a century around the world, it has toppled governments, changed laws, even stopped wars. At this late hour in this sad conflict, is there anything that can be learned from Mahatma Gandhi, from Nelson Mandela, from Martin Luther King? Passive resistance, civil disobedience, nonviolent struggle. Could what looks tonight like the least likely way, in fact, be the only way out of the Mideast horror? Or have things just gone too far? Is it absolutely too late for a nonviolent solution? Are the few dreamers left just dreaming? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by Jack Duvall. He's co-author of the new book, A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict. He's also director of the International Center on Nonviolent Policy. Good evening and welcome, Jack Duvall.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Jack Duvall, it seems perhaps like the oddest of times to be talking about nonviolence in the Middle East, but yet violence seems to be failing in a pretty grand way. You've written a big new book on the history of nonviolence in the last century. You followed the situation in Israel and around Israel closely. Is there any way that what you've learned about nonviolent struggle over the last century can still, even now, be applied in Israel?
It could be applied by Palestinians. In fact, it was applied by Palestinians before, during the first Intifada in 1987-88, which was mainly a nonviolent struggle because there at the time were no guns on the West Bank and the Gaza. The PLO and Yasser Arafat were thousands of miles away in Tunis and touched off by what was initially merely a traffic accident in which Palestinians were injured. A broad resistance rose up almost spontaneously, but leaders came to the fore who knew how to organize boycotts, civil disobedience strikes, and other measures. And the Palestinians resisted Israeli defense forces and frustrated the ability of Israelis to keep the West Bank and Gaza was made essentially ungovernable, but through nonviolent action. And unfortunately, that seems to be a precedent that the Palestinians have forgotten.
Jack Duvall,
so it can work.
We're going to come back and dig into that, and we're still not quite convinced that it can work there. But to understand the possibilities, take us through the century that you celebrate in your new book, A Force More Powerful. What was learned? Where did this start? And in very brief, what were the major accomplishments of nonviolence in the 20th century?
My co-author and I, Peter Ackerman, rarely, if ever, use the word nonviolence because we prefer to use terms like nonviolent conflict. And indeed, our organization is the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. It's a method of fighting for your rights or interests. It's a set of strategies for taking power. That's how it has been used, and that's how it has worked. It's not a state of grace. It's not a set of moral preferences. It may be that theoretically and philosophically, but on the ground, the way it's been used by popular movements struggling to overturn a dictator or to achieve human rights or to throw back a military occupier, it's been a set of strategies for engaging in conflicts.
So we've got it's not pacifism. It's not just striking the lotus position. It's getting up and doing something. And it is about struggle and conflict. What are the big examples from the 20th century that you cite?
More in the last 50 years than in the entire century. But of course, Gandhi's struggle against the British Raj in India was the great seminal struggle because he was at the same time the great theoretician of nonviolent action as well as its first practitioner on a national level. And the British were confronted with a roused nation, a nation that Gandhi succeeded in galvanizing against any further acquiescence to British rule in India. It became obvious to the British after the Salt Campaign of 1930 and 1931 that they couldn't govern India unless they were able to retain the consent of Indians, and that's what Gandhi put in jeopardy. Probably the most dramatic example of nonviolent sanctions being used effectively to overturn some kind of arbitrary power was when Solidarity rose up out of the Gdansk shipyard strikes in 1980. Managed to force the Polish communist regime to legalize the Solidarity trade union, and then even when it went underground, kept the pressure on the Polish regime to the point that the leaders of Solidarity had to be asked by the communist president of Poland in the late 80s to come to a round table and decide on a different future for Poland. The reason these popular movements succeed is because they tap much more deeply into the real nature of political power. Real political power doesn't come from the threat of violence or intimidation against someone because the government or the regime or the arbitrary power making that threat wants some sort of compliance, some sort of transaction with the person being threatened. So the people being threatened, which is to say the people, have a choice. They can continue to acquiesce or they can resist. And if they demonstrate that resistance abroad, across the broad sweep of the country, and target the pillars of support of that regime or that arbitrary power, they can overstretch the capacity of the government to repress that popular movement.
But tonight
it's
we're looking at political geometry. We're coming up on a break, but we're really looking at a very ambiguous plane of conflict in Israel in the West Bank. We want to come back and talk about whether or not this works against bayonets, whether it works against heavy firepower, and what happens when violence is brought into a movement that was nonviolent. We're talking with Jack Duvall. He's co-author of A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict. The question is, is violence failing the Israelis and Palestinians? And if it is there even now a non-violent way. Can the lessons of Gandhi, of Nelson Mandela, of Martin Luther King be applied in Israel and the occupied territories? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And at this late hour in the terrible conflict in the Middle East, where Colin Powell sits now looking for a way out of a bloody knot of conflict, we're asking, even now, is there a way in which nonviolent struggle might replace violent struggle? In fact, might nonviolent struggle be the only way out of the conflict in the Middle East? Our guest tonight is Jack Duvall. He's author of A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict. He's co-founder and director of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. He's a former counterintelligence officer in the U.S. Air Force. He's written speeches for four presidential candidates. The question for listeners tonight, for you, is violence failing the Israelis and the Palestinians? If it is there even now a nonviolent way? Is there another way, a radically different way out of the Middle East conflict? Or is it just too late? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Duvall, you write in the book that nonviolent struggle does work against violence, but it does not work with violence. Tell us about that.
It doesn't, because one of the reasons why the use of nonviolent action works successfully is because it distributes resistance throughout a civilian population. It gets everybody involved: old people, young people, women, people who would never want to join a violent struggle, would not be able to. There was a conference of nonviolent leaders from movements from the past and the present all over the world in January, sponsored by the U.S. Institute of Peace, that our center also sponsored. And there's a Palestinian leader there by the name of Jonathan Kutab, and he said, you know, the great frustration for those of us who believe in nonviolent action in the Palestinian community is that 95% of the Palestinian people have never even picked up a gun, but 95% of their rhetoric is the rhetoric of armed struggle. So there's a mismatch here.
What we need to do is to
provide the people with a method of struggle that grows up out of their own experience and is consistent with their own experience. And when you do that, a violent struggle only empowers a vanguard, usually an ideological vanguard that wants to take power. There are a very limited number of people who are willing or able to participate in a violent struggle. And that's one of the reasons why there is not a single instance in the last 100 years in which a liberation movement deliberately used violence to take power, took power, and then produced a regime that could be described as delivering freedom, human rights, mm-hmm. or democracy to its people.
The way regimes are born matters. But you're saying that nonviolent struggle does work even in the face of heavily armed opposition. It can work against guns.
Sure it can, because we just saw less than 2 years ago in Serbia, a ruler by the name of Slobodan Milosevic, who was called the Butcher of the Balkans, be taken down in less than a year after $1 billion worth of NATO bombs had been dropped on him. But he was taken down in less than a year after that by a nonviolent, student-sparked movement that distributed resistance to 70 or 80 Serbian cities and villages across the breadth of Serbia, far overstretching the capacity of Milosevic's repressive apparatus to crack down. And just as your reporter from Venezuela said earlier, when civil society turns out and shows its determination by a number of different kinds of acts that it's willing to participate in, that its face is set against that of an arbitrary regime, there are even people within the police and the security services who think twice about carrying out the orders of repression. The military and police support of a regime can crack wide open. That may well be what happened in Venezuela. It is certainly what happened in Serbia. It's even to some extent what happened in South Africa, when after several years of internecine and catastrophic violence between the regime and black South Africans in the townships, a set of leaders decided that violence simply wasn't working, and that quite apart from the ANC's commitment to armed struggle, new organizations were needed to work at the township level, to enlist the support of local people, to engage in kinds of nonviolent action which don't give the regime or the occupying power targets to shoot at.
Jack Duvall, I was struck in your book by how saddened you must have been in writing this about how developments have unfolded in Israel. You've got a large and loving chapter devoted to the birth of the Intifada. It's very admiring. You talk about how a political consciousness came over the Palestinians, how they withheld taxes and fees and didn't cooperate with ID cards. You talk about how it echoed Gandhi's own movement. But I wonder if by the end you yourself didn't come away feeling betrayed or even naive in the way the Intifada is described in the book.
No, I don't think so. I mean, that conflict, that phase of the Palestinian struggle, we think was rather successful in breaking a stalemate, which had existed for a long period of time, shifting political forces within Israel, producing movement to the negotiations in Madrid and Oslo, which made substantial progress in at least identifying the terms of an eventual solution.
But it sounds ironically, tragically, like that very sense of community that grew up in a first peaceful way also laid the groundwork for the suicide bombings or the martyrdom that's going on now. You write about how initially Palestinians felt so isolated when they were arrested, but when so many got arrested, you say during the uprising, the jailing of a family member became a source of pride because it showed that he'd been resisting. Whole communities would visit mothers to congratulate them that their sons had been arrested in the same spirit shown by the son of Gandhi's secretary who had run after the police van in which his father was carried off, delightedly shouting that he hoped he'd be gone for at least 2 years. And this sounds for all the world like the embrace that's now given to the family of suicide bombers.
What happened? The Palestinian civil society that existed in 1987-88 still exists today. What Jonathan Kutab said about Palestinians is still true today. 95% of them have never picked up a gun. The potential for engaging in civilian resistance to military incursions or military occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza and to Israeli control, which is a factor in preventing the advent of an independent Palestinian entity, that potential still exists. The question is whether political leaders among the Palestinians are going to forswear violence, neutralize those who are using violence to the extent that that is possible, and not allow the rhetoric of the struggle to be hijacked by those who are determined to use violence for their own narrow purposes, not necessarily to advance the Palestinian cause.
And what a challenge. Jack Duvall, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Mubarak Awad. He's director of Nonviolence International in Washington, D.C., an American-Palestinian who you write about in your book as having been very involved in the early peaceful days of resistance. Good evening and welcome, Mubarak Awad.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Mubarak Awad, we've read about how way back in the 80s you were instrumental in gathering Palestinians to pursue nonviolent struggle against the Israeli forces in their midst. In the last 18 months, we've seen that turn radically violent to the point of repeated drumbeat of suicide bombings. What's gone wrong? Can it be salvaged? Is there any slight hope, any glimmer of hope for a nonviolent solution in this region today?
I think there is a lot, because I don't think that the Israelis, with all their weapons, are going to make a difference in stopping the Palestinian aspiration. And I don't think that the Palestinian aspiration in a suicide bombing, which are very, very few, you could count them on your hands, are going to stop the Israeli from attacking. And both sides, they have to find another solution, another way of dealing with the issues. And I think that we tend most of the time to deal with so much emotion on the aspect of now, rather than looking what really could come out of that.
How do you get past that, Mubarak Awad? Ariel Sharon says Israel is fighting for its very existence. And on the other side of the green line, we see night after night Palestinian youths interviewed saying they're ready to become suicide bombers.
And the same thing. I mean, if both sides, if the Palestinian and Israeli, say that Israel, with all its weapons, fighting for its existence, the existence of the Palestinian have no weapons. And if they choose a suicide bombing to have for their existence, then it will be a sad existence for both.
Ari Fleischer, President Bush's spokesman, called on Yasser Arafat tonight. He said this would be a good day after the suicide bombing today to renounce terrorism. We haven't heard that from Yasser Arafat. If you were in charge, Mubarak Awad, given everything that's happened, would you go on the radio in the West Bank tonight and call on the Palestinian people to pursue a nonviolent way?
Of course. I mean, I'm in the business of nonviolence. I'm opposing killing on any... It doesn't matter what the reason is. I'm opposing of even trying to push hard that we have to see each other as a human being, both Israeli and Palestinians.
But would it work? Would it get the Palestinians what they want?
I mean, we have to understand that even when I started the nonviolence campaign in the 80s, Israel couldn't deal with the nonviolence campaign at all. They couldn't deal with the tax cut and demonstrations and not paying taxes and marches. And Israel is more happy to use its weapons and to use its power in guns and tanks because that's how they are raised.
Israel did jail 29,000 Palestinians in the first year of the Intifada when it was not anything like the violent effort that it is now.
And that's an acceptable concept for us as Palestinians. We have to take nonviolence as it is a war, as much as war is what's going on. The only thing, the difference between war and nonviolence is that in a nonviolent struggle, you'll have very few to be killed. And we cannot make a nonviolence on a very small scale. It has to be on a large scale. It has to be an acceptance of a lot of people to be homegrown. And I think that's what the Israelis were afraid of, and that's why I was deported.
But Jack Duvall, you hear Mubarak Awad, he says they tried the nonviolent way. The Israelis were intolerant even of that. On the other hand, as you point out in the book, the Palestinians turned to a very violent path, and you're saying that nonviolence and violence don't mix. How do you separate the two now?
I think it's easy to separate the two. I think that the hope that have to come out of a nonviolent struggle is that a hope that it will bring better than violence. And if it's a comparison, you have to compare it. If nonviolence cannot have fruits, why using it? And the same if violence doesn't have fruits, why using it? For me as a Palestinian, I fully believe that the fruits of nonviolence would be much better than any violence that's going on.
Jack Duvall, come in with us here. How do we make the turn?
Let's stop looking at it as a crisis that has to be resolved and realize that what is happening here is a struggle by the Palestinian people to achieve their rights. This is their struggle. They are the protagonist. They have the initiative. They have a choice as to the means of struggle in which they wish to engage.
Well, you're defining it that way, but many Israelis see it as a struggle for Israeli survival.
Let me finish my thought. The question is, how is the fundamental conflict between Israelis and Palestinians will not be resolved until and unless the Palestinians achieve a state. The question is how that's going to happen. Now, if a diplomatic solution cannot be imposed, there is another way for Palestinians who are the protagonists to take up a struggle, a mass civilian resistance that has worked so many times before that it's absurd to believe that for some reason Palestinians can't make it work while South Africans made it work, while in some respects the Poles made it work, while peoples throughout Europe successfully resisted the Nazis and civilian societies in Europe. I mean, there are so many examples of this mode of struggle working that I refuse to believe that it wouldn't work for Palestinians. The choice, however, of the means of struggle must be made by Palestinians.
And we've certainly heard Mubarak Awad promoting it tonight. And I know you have to go, but I want to thank you for joining us, Mubarak Awad. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're most welcome.
Jack Duvall, hang on. We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Oded is on the line. Welcome, Oded. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that there's a fundamental misconception here, namely that the leadership of all three active groups in Israel, which would be Arafat, Sharon, and whatever is a distributed leadership of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, are completely uninterested in nonviolence because their goals would not be served by it.
Well, I think we see that, but the question is, I guess, how do you get around it? If you don't have a Gandhi standing up front, and let me put it straight to you, Jack Duvall, when you have leadership perhaps on all sides that may not be interested in a nonviolent way forward, what can the public do on either side?
There are many organizations, many civil society organizations. There are many leaders in the Palestinian community other than the ones you've just mentioned. You've identified the most politically prominent, the ones that know how to get to microphones, the ones that are covered by the news media. I should comment that one of the reasons why there is terrorism is because of the nature of news coverage of terrorist incidents. This is for the purpose of creating a spectacle of radicalizing political perceptions and thus enabling extreme groups to come to the fore in the leadership of a community or of a movement.
But it's also part of the air we breathe today. Oded, let me put it to you. Do you see a way to nonviolence with leadership that may not be interested?
Frankly, no, for the simple reason that the goals of the leadership have nothing to do with what nonviolence is about. Nonviolence might be able to help Palestinians and Israelis live together. Neither Arafat nor Sharon nor anyone else who has a chance to have power wants that. Therefore, they're all involved in proving that there is no way forward with the people together, and either one must be destroyed or transferred out or defeated.
So you're saying we're only left with these kind of nihilistic solutions, conquest or deportation?
Look, let's not impose on the entire Palestinian people the assumption that they are unable to find leaders and express themselves on a mass basis in a way that enables them to choose a different form of struggle. This has been done too many other in extreme circumstances in too many other countries. There were all through the 1980s, there were people who predicted the only way that the conflict in South Africa would be resolved would be through some enormous conflagration.
Meltdown.
There were radicals on the left and within the ANC who said the only way we'll bring down the government in Pretoria is by bombing enough factories.
But the black leader in South Africa was Nelson Mandela. It was not Yasser Arafat.
There are Palestinian leaders. There are plenty of moderate Palestinian leaders who are not interested in having the Palestinian struggle hijacked by extremists who are dedicated to violence.
Does it matter? Is it conclusive that the leader at the top is not willing to stand up and support a nonviolent path?
You know, that appears to be the case at the moment. I think there have been many instances in the past in which when a conflict worsens for one side and some leaders appear responsible for that, then leadership can, in fact, and has been often in the past replaced. We're in the midst of a conflict right now. We're in the midst of a conflict which, looked at from the Palestinian side, analyzing it coldly, has been hijacked by extremist elements and is sharpening a crisis that has become a military conflict now.
Jack Duvall, we're giving you sharp questions tonight just because the situation looks so insoluble, but we're learning from you. We've got to take a short break. Can truth speak to power when guns are blazing, when bombs are bursting? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight if, at this awful hour in the Middle East, somehow nonviolent struggle might in fact be the only way out. Can nonviolent struggle work when violence towers over everything? And if we bring the lessons of nonviolent struggle to the Middle East today, where should they be aimed? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Jack Duvall, co-author of A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict. And now by caller Dave. Dave, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Thanks. It's a nice show. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you, Dave.
Okay. I'd like to comment one thing. I mean, your guess is generalizing all the incident happening in the world and compare it to the Palestinian and make it the Palestinian conflict and the Israeli is a simple.
Well, we're trying to learn from it. I don't think anyone believes it's simple, Dave, but what's your view?
Okay. What I'm saying, if we look at the South African problem first and we look at what happened to the government, we see the whole world will boycott the government. And that's why the nonviolent movement succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at the Palestinian and the Israelis, for instance, and you see that Israel is backed by United States 100%, and United States give Israel $10 billion a year.
Or three, maybe.
Money.
Mm-hmm.
And how you expect the Israeli to yield at least a little bit for the Palestinians?
Dave, it's a great question. Let me put it right to Jack Duvall. And what Dave raises is the moral ambiguity in this conflict, Jack Duvall, and the fact that you don't have unanimous support on one side or the other. It's you can't get agreement on who even the good guys and bad guys are. How do you solve it in a case like that?
He's absolutely right that there is significant support in the United States for Israel. One of the reasons why there is support at this moment in the United States for Israel is because Israel is perceived as being under the threat of suicide bombings. Now, if the Palestinian resistance were exclusively nonviolent and suicide bombings weren't occurring, any military action that the Israelis took on the West Bank and the Gaza, which is exactly what happened in 1987 and 1988, would split support for Israelis not only within the United States, but also inside Israel itself. In 1987-88, the nonviolent intifada gave enormous encouragement to and helped to increase the size of the Israeli peace movement, which gave powerful political support to forces within Israel which wanted to reach a settlement with Palestinians. So the choice of struggle absolutely matters in affecting and influencing the nature of your opposition.
Of course, and yet we saw a prime minister assassinated. We've seen both sides turn to deep violence. And behind all that are these the distrust of fundamental motives. Is it really to get a two-state solution, or are people on one or both sides fundamentally interested in pushing the others out entirely? Jack, stand by if you would. I want to bring in Mark Rosenblum. Mark is founder and political director of Americans for Peace Now. He's a professor of history at Queen's College. He was at the Madrid Peace Conference, and he's had a lot to do with the Israeli peace movement. Good evening and welcome, Mark Rosenblum.
My pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. Mark, I think you've heard the question that we're raising tonight, whether even at this late and awful hour there is any way, or maybe the only way to go ahead, is for nonviolent struggle to be reintroduced here. Do you see a way for that to happen now?
Yes, I think the point about the choice of how one struggles being absolutely critical is true. And I think that when you start with the two current leaders, Sharon and Arafat, you have, at best, intentions that look very, very suspect. Sharon's goal of defeating terrorism, or is he reoccupying the West Bank and Gaza? Arafat's goal, is it really a war of independence, or is it a war of liquidation?
Well, we got that, Mark, but what if that ambiguity also resides deep in the breast of each population?
Well, I think that what resides deep in the breast of the population is due to policies and choices that leaders are making here. And I'd argue to you that one of the things, I think it's not too late, but it will take leaders that will be able to reverse a process. What Arafat specifically squandered over the last 8 years since Oslo began is he had the Israeli public generally concluding that the PLO and the L in PLO stood not for liquidation of Israel, but for a Palestinian state. The use of negotiations and hope for some kind of reconciliation through nonviolence became a critical part of what converted the Israelis to accept in principle the idea of a real Palestinian state, not a fraudulent one. And I think what the Palestinian leadership under Arafat has failed to do by virtue of choice of weapons in the last 18 months, and I highlight and underline the difference between this intifada and the first intifada.
Understood. Let me ask you this, Mark. Jack Duvall suggests that populations can stand up and link hands even when the leadership won't. Can you see that possibility here? Could we wake up one morning and find Israelis, you know, crossing the green line to embrace Palestinians in spite of everything? Or is that a totally vain hope?
No, I think it's not as if Palestinians and Israelis are not trying to articulate a primal enough and looking for partners on the other side to link hands with. Sari Nusseibeh. There are Palestinians that really are struggling to engage in joint activity and by themselves activity in nonviolence. But I think in the midst of the current raging battlefield on both sides, you have to buy some diplomatic space for these kinds of individuals and organizations on both sides of the Palestine-Israel divide to be able to get some political traction. And therefore, I for one think a ceasefire and just buying some time through, even if it's a very transitional diminishment of violence and terrorism, with people on both sides trying to generate a new vision of how they want to interact with each other is necessary. I don't poo-poo the diplomacy of the moment to get back to some kind of Palestinians need to represent their goals to Israel, a state next to, not in place of Israel, and the Israelis need to represent their goals to the Palestinians as a real viable two-state solution. And
that clearly looks necessary, but you say it's got to be in context of a ceasefire. The ceasefire has proven absolutely bloodily elusive for all this time. Jack Duvall, let me put it to you. Can you give us a concise example in some other setting, we're in the midst of conflict, that one or both sides were not willing to let go of, a nonviolent struggle emerged from beneath it that somehow succeeded anyway? Does that ever happen?
That is what happened in South Africa. The question is this: can the moral asymmetry of the struggle that prevailed in 1987-88 be revived today on behalf of the Palestinians, only if the picture that is presented to both the Israeli population as well as to those who support Israel today, which is to say the United States, is changed from one of suicide bombers opposing Israeli defense forces to Palestinian civilians resisting in various ways forms of Israeli control, Israeli incursions, or Israeli actions vis-a-vis the Palestinian population.
Well, let me put that to Mark Rosenblum as a test. Mark, do you agree that there is fundamentally a moral asymmetry here? And by that, Jack Duvall is suggesting that morality is more on the Palestinian side in the fundamental questions over land and where people live. Do you agree, as a peace activist, do you agree with that?
No, I don't completely. I think I do not have any qualms about describing the Israeli policies and their relationship vis-a-vis the Palestinians as one of occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. But even occupied people, and I think Jeff would not disagree with this, even an occupied population has both moral and political responsibilities for how they communicate their desires, their intentions. And so I, for one, don't find this moral asymmetry to be so powerful. I think the Israelis have a very compelling case, and it's not for foolish reasons that there is broad public support for the Israelis in the face of the torrential murderous terrorism that's taking place. But I think one point here that's important that has not been mentioned. The Israelis are very vulnerable and available in a positive sense to a civil disobedience, nonviolent campaign.
By the Palestinians.
By the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. This is a public, in spite of what you read and see talked about on TV and on radio, that is overwhelmingly on the broad strategic questions. Should settlements be removed? Should there be a territorially viable Palestinian state? Should East Jerusalem and Jerusalem itself be politically redivided? On these questions, the Israeli public remains pragmatic and conciliatory, where they are hardline and uncompromising is on tactical questions relating to defense against violence and terrorism. So a nonviolent choice by a leadership that to this day we have to acknowledge represents a bottleneck leadership by Arafat. And here's the difference that was already mentioned between Arafat and Nelson Mandela. Arafat has demonstrated an unwillingness to, in a persistent way, define Palestinian goals in a way that would speak to the Israeli Jewish public that I think would agree to end the occupation in terms that did not have what they perceived as a gun to their head.
But Mark, Arafat's only one man. The Hamas is much larger than him, and potential population of bombers is larger still.
In my opinion, the fundamental issue is the one group that has made the great ascent in Palestinian support in popularity today is not Hamas or Islamic Jihad or the Islamic opposition. It's a group of people you hear talked about in terms of the Tanzim or the Al-Aqsa Intifada that's grown out of the Fatah new generation. These people have generated broad popular support through armed struggle in a war of independence.
And this is Arafat's circle.
This is Arafat's circle. They engage in armed struggle and even suicide terrorism within the Green Line, even though their goals, I believe, are not to destroy the state of Israel. And they've mixed the means of struggle, and therefore have not communicated to the Israelis a more compromising ultimate goal.
Mark Rosenblum, we've got it, and we thank you for giving it to us so clearly and passionately, and thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Mark Rosenblum is founder and political director of Americans for Peace Now. I want to turn to our callers. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. So I have two thoughts that I think I can tie together. The first is that, you know, Gandhi, you know, he took on nonviolence as a method of shaming Britain before the world.
Yep.
So that they would see their wrong actions. And what I think needs to be done is kind of the same philosophy here.
But who will shame who here, Imran?
That's exactly the question. And maybe the solution is this, is that, you know, neither party really understands the other party's pain. So the Palestinians don't really understand European Jews' pain from the Holocaust. And likewise, many American Jews, as well as Israelis, don't understand what it's like to live under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. And
but surely there's enough literature out there, and we've all seen the stories over years of people reaching across to try and understand the other side. What's it going to take?
So, well, here's an idea. I mean, and it could be a program where you take Palestinians and you take them to, let's say, the Holocaust Memorial, and you show them this is what we went through, and then return. You take Israelis and American Jews because they're, I think, instrumental in part of the stance that's taken. And you bring them into the West Bank, into Gaza, and let them see what it's like to live under the conditions of the Palestinians.
Imran, we hear you and feel you thinking for peace there, and we appreciate it tonight. I want to get another call in. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to sort of harken back to something that your guest mentioned earlier, and that is that clearly there must be more moderate people both within the Palestinian society and in the Arab world at large.
Well, I'm sure there are, but these are both societies that have put forward their own leaders willingly.
But what I'm saying is There have to be these more moderate voices. So why aren't we hearing from them? Is it that they're not speaking up? Is it that the media just is not giving them the same kind of...
We got the question, but we're losing you. We thank you for your call, Mark. What about it, Jack Duvall? How do more peaceful voices work their way to the fore? And are they still even there? We know that the Israeli peace movement was much stronger 2 years ago than it is tonight. And sure. For that matter, that we can see how Palestinians have been radicalized.
Those voices are there. Those leaders are there. The caller is right to suggest that they have great difficulty getting airtime and being heard in the West. They certainly are heard communally among their own people. And you know, we can't sort out for Palestinians what they must sort out, which is how they're going to be led and what strategy they're going to use in going forward and trying to win themselves a state in this continuing conflict.
Jack, we've just got 30 seconds left.
What kind of a conflict will it be?
What kind will it be, and how do you break through to nonviolence? What does history suggest?
They're going to have to learn that violence, particularly terrorism, doesn't work. It got them Ariel Sharon, and it's getting the military action in the West Bank and the Gaza. It's not working. And once
they seem to be slow learners. We don't want to go through this course again and again.
Well, the conflict will continue. The question is how the conflict will go on, and that decision is one for Palestinians to make.
And ultimately,
nonviolent resistance would be a method to turn around the equation we see on the ground today and to come to a different and a more fruitful result.
We can pray for that. Jack Duvall, co-author of A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can learn more about Americans for Peace Now and Nonviolence International by going to our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.